Okay, today we have does everybody have a handout? There should be two handouts. One of them has a picture on the back. The other one has writing on both sides. The one that has writing on both sides is an excerpt from a classic book about the flood called The Genesis Flood. And you'll see the reference on the back at the bottom of the page. It was written in 1961, so it's pretty old, yes? On two sides. Okay, well, we have a few more. You got a misprint there. Okay. Which one is it that didn't get printed? Uh-oh. The second side. Oh, he made some more. Sure, take that one. I have a few more. Pass those out. Everyone gets two separate copies. If I hadn't been so lazy, I would have stapled them together for you, but you'd take them apart anyway. So, okay, he was trying to be helpful and Xerox some more, and he only got one side of it. So, but here's a few more. If you got a defective one, we'll let him know, and he'll give you whichever one is wrong. So this one, which is a critique, you can read, it's kind of a summary of some of the things we'll talk about today. But all of the things he says are still valid. And what we're talking about today, we've shown that there was a flood. We know about when it occurred. The boat is still sitting there, turned to stone in the Ararat Mountains. And we've spent quite a bit of time showing that fits all of the bills as far as how long it is and its shape and everything. It looks just like what God told them to build. And so we are confident that happened. It's over a mile up in the mountains. How a boat that's as big as the Queen Mary ever got up in a mile up in the mountains in Turkey is difficult to explain otherwise. There are a lot of things about the theory of evolution that are difficult to explain. And that's why it takes a long course in college and in high school to get the ideas across. But like a lot of wrong ideas, there's a lot of deception involved. And I want to show you some things about geology, which is the basis, really, of the theory of evolution this morning. And remember, these are the people who are saying, we want to teach this in high school without any having to justify it or having to combat creationism and all of that. Sure, they would like to be able to do that without anybody to oppose them, because there are really critical problems with it. So today we're just going to talk about problems in geology. And next week, which is the last lesson in the series, we're going to talk about the proof part of the thing. But today, Just it's kind of a slideshow. We're gonna go to the Grand Canyon and some places and look and see what's actually out there. So let's get started here. This is where we ended last week. The Grand Canyon. And most of you have been there. If you haven't been there, it's worth a trip. It's a beautiful place to go. And someone came up afterwards last time and said, in the gift shop, they're still selling a pretty good-sized book about the creationist view of the Grand Canyon. The evolutionists tried to have the book removed from the gift shop, and I'm not surprised. But the judges ruled against them, and so it's still for sale there, as I understand it. So here we see the layering of the Grand Canyon. And what's remarkable about the Grand Canyon, what makes it beautiful, of course, are these layers, which are sedimentary rock. There are two basic different kinds of rocks. Those that are born underwater as sediment in a lake or an ocean or something like that. And so at one time, these were all at the bottom of a sea or an ocean, and were laid down. As the different kinds of sediment change, the colors of the rocks change. Now, up here at the top is the second big kind of rock, and as opposed to sedimentary rock, we have igneous rock. And I don't know if any of you have had any geology, what that word means. It's rock born in fire. It's rock generally that comes out of volcanoes. And in this case, we're looking at granite. A couple of granite, what they call throats, which were at the base of a volcano as it was erupting, and eventually the volcano stopped erupting, and this rock solidified down in the throat of the volcano and never got ejected. And in this case, it crystallizes and slowly cools, and because it cools slowly instead of rapidly, it crystallizes, and it has crystals or minerals in it, and it makes one of many different kinds of igneous rock. There's marble and granite, and well, we're not going to talk about that kind of rock today. Apparently, there were volcanoes here that shot way up in the air, and this was at the base of them. But notice that the sediment part is layered around these. This apparently came later, and that has worn away in the weathering of the Grand Canyon. So, one of the interesting things we note about this is that these layers are all horizontal, and they run for miles without any twists or turns or tilts in them, which argues that they're relatively late in laying them down as far as geologists look at them. But the curious thing about it is geologists put these layers at the very bottom. What you see on top is not the top of the geological strata. What you see at the top is really pretty far down at the bottom. And so when you look at the Colorado Plateau, as geologists have put it together in their books, here's the Grand Canyon over here, and the various layers of the Grand Canyon are shown here. But if you travel up through Utah and other places, you'll see that there's a Zion Canyon with a Navajo layer here, and further on up at Bryce Canyon, the beautiful spires and so on of Bryce Canyon make it an excellent place to visit. It's a soft rock, which is thought to be later in laying it down, and so it's at the top. It's at the top of all of these layers, and you look at all of these layers here, and the age of the layers as it's interpreted by geologists. And when it says 60 here, it's not talking about 60 years. It's talking about millions of years, and so 60 million years ago, somewhere along in here is the point at which the, according to geologists and according to evolutionists, the meteorite hit the Earth and destroyed the dinosaurs. I mean, we're talking about dinosaurs as being relatively recent in their view of things at 65 million years ago. And so we mentioned that the Earth was hit by a comet or an asteroid, and it devastated the Earth, but that may be the point at which all of the animals died anyway because God had flooded the Earth. And the only survivors of that event were the ones that were on the ark. Okay. So here's all these names. You don't have, there'll be a test, but I'm not going to ask you for all these names. Okay, so relax. So here are the layers that occur in the Grand Canyon. And here are the layers that occur. You'll see some of these, mostly one or two sandstones. Now, there are three basic kinds of layers that are laid down in sediment. Some are sandstone, that is sand, which is laid down underwater and eventually has other kinds of minerals percolating through it that cement the sand grains together. But it's mostly just sand. And so it's somewhat more crumbly than the others. And it's lighter colored in these, with names like Waheap and Navajo and Coconino down here at the Grand Canyon. Now, the second kind of sedimentary rock, which is similar to sandstone, but laid down full of calcium carbonate, which is alkaline, and it's called limestone. And so there's a lot of material in limestone sediment, which is cemented harder than sandstone, and it contains fossils of various kinds that we'll look at in a little while. So it contains quite a bit of material organic material as well as predominantly calcium carbonate, which is known as lime. And so when you heat this layer of rock in a kiln of some sort and burn away all the organic material, what you're left with is fairly pure lime, which is one of the components of cement. And so it's a basis of a large industry in our world. Portland cement. All right, and the third type, which are the darker layers here, sandstone, I think, here they are up here. Limestone is green there and here and down here. And the third one is shale. Shale is rock that's formed out of clay, basically, and clay and a variety of minerals that are mixed in with it, but a lot of organic material. And so shale is usually the layer that contains the most fossils. And so it's layered together and hardened in such a way that it can be split open. And so you can take the shale and hit it on the edge with a hammer, and it'll break apart in layers. And in between the layers is where you find many of the beautiful fossils that we'll look at in a minute. So those three, and some combinations of them. Of course, anytime science makes some kind of a declaration like this, there are three kinds of basic sedimentary rocks, but then they always add, well, some of the combinations occur, some don't fit exactly in one category or another, but these account for 99% of the sedimentary rocks. Okay, question. Shale is oil and gas. That's right. And that's because it contains all of this organic material, which under heat and pressure does indeed convert into oil and gas and coal. Okay, so there you have the material from the perspective of producing oil, which is important in Texas. So here we have, but for our purposes, we have basically three kinds, and all of, if you think about this, this is only about the distance. The Grand Canyon's a mile deep, and so if you look, we're looking, if you pile all these layers up, we're looking several miles into the earth. It's sedimentary rock all the way up and down. Scattered igneous rock here and there where there have been intrusions of volcanic lava and magma from the liquid rock underneath. It intrudes into the sedimentary rock. So, a lot of the living things now came after God created animals and plants, of course. The earth may be much older than that. I think we're on shaky ground when we try to argue that the earth is only as old as living things. That's not necessarily the case, because God created the heavens and the earth when? To begin with, wasn't it? He created the heavens and the earth, or in the beginning, it says in our translations. So the earth may be much older. And so when someone says, but the earth is 5.5 billion years old or 4.5 billion years old. Well, we don't know. It could be. Time in God's view, I mean, that's in view of eternity, 4.5 billion years isn't very much, right? So we don't really have any information about that, and I don't think we should argue about that part of it. But we find in all of these sedimentary layers, we find living things. And so that argues that they came since creation. Okay, and you have on the back side of one of your handouts a black and white version of this. I'm sorry, our Xerox machine's not in color, but anyway, you'll just have to suffer along with the rest of us. Okay. Now, I also gave you this because the details here are in fine print. This is the part that you'll be tested over later, maybe someday. But I want you to notice a few things we're going to talk about in here. There are four basic time zones here. There's five of them listed here. Eras. The geologist divides time into eras and periods, and then and names all of these periods. This is a table out of that 1961 book, and some of these things have changed a bit. Science is always updating what it's put out, and so you can't take anything they've published as the final word in the matter, but it's similar to this. The Paleozoic is primitive life in their view. The Mesozoic is the Middle Age, of course, and then the Cenozoic is the most recent era. And we're still, I suppose, in the Cenozoic era. And so then there are all of these periods, and you'll read about these from time to time. The Mississippian is pretty important, because in these sections down through here is where there's a lot of coal, indicating a lot of organic matter, particularly plant life that was buried there in those periods. But anyway, we'll see down here a few things that we'll talk about later on, and you can mark down reptiles here and birds here and ultimately mammals at the top. And further on down, the word I want you to pick out of here is trilobites. Let's see, where the extinction of the trilobites in the Permian, and then the rise of the trilobites all the way back in the Cambrian. The Cambrian layer, as they identify it, is the oldest layer. It would be the layer in which the newly created animals and plants first appeared in this series. So you see land plants come pretty early, as well as, and all of these things lived in the ocean to start with, and so the scientist views this as beginning in the oceans and eventually migrating onto land. Okay, now, as we proceed, you'll see that there's some difficulties with this orderly progression from simple animals buried with the trilobites at the bottom. As we progress upward through this series, the animals get more complex, and so they've concluded that they evolved from the simple animals. There's no proof of that, but that's the way it looks to the geologists. But there's problems with that interpretation that I'll show you in a minute. The bottom two, the Proterozoic, the living things that they find there are bacteria and algae, and they're not real sure that they are fossils because they're microscopic. They could be minerals or something else, and it's hard to tell because there's not any detail. So that's before there was life, and then at the Cambrian we have what's known as the Cambrian explosion. It's worth saying that all of the major kinds of animals, now not land animals necessarily, but all of the major types of animals as the scientists view them started, they all appear all at once. It's kind of interesting. It's called an explosion of animal life in the Cambrian period, and so they find all kinds of things in those fossils, all kinds of fossils in those layers. That they don't find before then. Okay, so now in Nebraska there's a graveyard. It's called a fossil graveyard. And this is kind of typical of the way many of these fossils occur. They happen in profusion of bones and remains of animals. Here are major animals. This is an upper layer in the series, but notice that there's all kinds of bones from, they estimate something like 4,000 animals buried all in this one area that all died at one time. To start with, you can imagine something really catastrophic happened that drove all of these animals together. There are mammals and reptiles of all sorts in here. And you can see there's a big old jawbone of some sort there. And it's hard to identify until you take all of these bones out and examine them. Then you can begin to piece together what kinds of animals were there. But the point I want you to remember is that a lot of animals died all at once. And having, in my view, having been driven to high ground in a flood and then overwhelmed, makes good sense for something like this and buried in the silt and sand of the flood. That's in Nebraska. You can go see that. I'm not sure The picture that I took that from didn't tell me where, but some of you may know where that is. This is a case of fossil fish, and this is a plate of limestone that I have that has herring in it, and it's supposedly very ancient, and yet the fish look very modern, and so you can see quite a bit of detail. These are only a couple inches long. They're pretty small, but they come in bigger sizes, and they're all buried together in one layer as though there was a school of fish that was overwhelmed with the silt and sand and compacted, and it eventually hardened into stone. So here again, they seem to have died in some sort of a catastrophe. And the fish, some of them are pretty good size. This is about 10 inches from one side to the other. This is a fish called a pompano. It's not exactly like a modern pompano, but it's pretty close, and so they identify it as being that species. And you know what that is? Have you ever eaten one? I mean, it's a food fish, I think, in Hawaii. And so completely contained in a slab of rock here. It's been cracked as they got it out. Now, they harvest quarry, really, pretty big chunks of this layered rock, and then they split it open, and sometimes in doing that, it gets broken. But it's quite colorful and quite interesting to see. These occur, of course, in museums and so on. They're shown. And you might recognize this little guy. He's about 2 feet long. Something called a caiman, with a narrow snout like that. And that's characteristic of alligators in South America, and I guess some in Central America. But it's a fossil that's supposedly millions of years old, and yet it's almost identical to the ones that you see alive today. So if there's evolution going on, it didn't evolve. It was perfectly happy to stay like it was. This is probably one of the most famous fossils, a bird fossil, called Archaeopteryx. Now, archaeo means ancient, and opteryx has to do with the fact, pteryx has to do with the fact that it has wings, which means it's a bird. And so over here you see what they think it looked like. This is the way it looks like in the rocks. You can see the imprint of the feathers here, which is unusual for these fossils. This one was found in Germany somewhere. And since then, many others have been located as well. They're finding fossils like this in China now. And as some of you may read in the newspapers or magazines that they've discovered a new bird-like fossil. And they're trying to prove that the birds evolved from the reptiles. And so they're really excited about this one because, as you can see in the mock-up here, it isn't clear here in the head of this particular individual. But it has teeth, a bird with teeth. Did you ever hear the expression as scarce as hen's teeth? Well, this hen had teeth. And it was interesting that about 10 years ago, they isolated a gene in mice that is involved in the formation of teeth in a mouse. And when they transferred that, not into birds that developed completely, but into bird embryos, then the birds develop teeth. They're missing a gene. That's why they don't have teeth. And that sort of a change can happen pretty easily. But the other thing is it has this tailbone goes all the way out into its tail here. You can see it's a thickened area there behind the foot. And that's not characteristic of modern birds, but otherwise, and of course, they don't know what color it was, so they made it white, I guess, here. But it would look pretty much like a crow. It's about the size of an average crow. So it clearly is a bird, and it's a bird that we don't have in our modern world. But of course, a lot of the things that were even carried on the ark, we talked about this before, and released, they didn't survive in our modern world because it was a... It, they came from a world that was uniformly warm and no wind into a world that has storms and rain and heat and cold, and lots of things didn't survive. And you recognize this guy, and you'd say, it's even down to the venation in the wings, it's identical to modern dragonflies, except for the fact that it's about a foot across. They're also called mosquito hawks because they do eat mosquitoes. And you might imagine that have one of these things buzz you, it would be a little more cause for concern than the ones that we see now. But many animals live much longer in the pre-flood days, and so they probably grew bigger. Didn't have winter to kill them off. All right. Probably so, yeah. Be careful not to shoot the lion. Yeah, you have to shoot the dragonfly. Now, not all, just an insert here, not all of the fossils occur in rocks, okay? This is amber. The texture in the background comes from the fact that I copied this picture out of a book. But you can easily see what it is. It's a fly that's supposedly something like 100 million years old, and yet it's pretty much identical to a housefly. So a lot of things didn't really evolve over time. That's one of the big problems that evolutionists have. And every now and then, they find something like a fish that they thought was extinct, and suddenly someone catches one. And there was a big stir about that about 40 years ago when they began to catch coelacanths. You might remember that. There's a pretty good sized fish that they had known only as fossils and thought it was a primitive kind of a fish that might have led to those that have legs because it had big paddles on the sides. And it was a fish that's 4 or 6 feet long, a great big fish, and so they concluded that it had died out long, long, long ago. And then they began to discover that fishermen knew about them and were catching them in the Mediterranean Sea and off the coast of Africa and off the coast of India. Now there are a number of sites where coelacanths are known. It's not an abundant fish, but it is known, and it has survived essentially unchanged from the fossils that are supposedly millions of years old. Okay, here's a plant. And I put this one in to show you something. It's an optical illusion, really, that you have to study for a minute before you realize what it is. It looks like two identical pieces. But the bottom one is what's called a cast. It fits over the top one. The leaves actually are kind of three-dimensional as they sit in this rock. And when they split it open, it perfectly divided along this frond of material. And it's a fairly primitive plant, but if you look at get your eyes to look at it just right, these are indentations in the rock, and these are prominence above the rock. Can you make it look that way with your eyes? And so this is a cast that fits down over that, and so it bears the impression of the leaves, but it isn't actually any leaf material here. It's just a perfect impression of what's in the top part. We're going to talk about a cast in a minute that's kind of interesting. Now, in our daughter moved some years ago to live up at Glen Rose, Texas. And I don't know if you know where Glen Rose is. It's just south of Fort Worth. And so it's a place you can go visit. There's a park there, a dinosaur park. And there's a river that runs through there called the Paluxy River. And here it is in the background. Here again, we have this texture thing that comes. It's a moire effect of copying something out of a book. And in the riverbed are these dinosaur tracks. You can see them all through here. They were uncovering. The men are working in the distance here and piling up the dirt on one side to uncover this layer of rock that is in the Cretaceous period, which is about the time that dinosaurs died out. And these dinosaurs evidently ran through the river bottom while it was wet. And so they leave tracks. And eventually that was silted over with another layer of sand or something, and it hardened. It hardened differentially so that you can wash these tracks out now and dig them out. And there's about a dozen different kinds of dinosaurs. And so you can go to this. Some of these have been dug out of the riverbed and taken to a nearby museum. And it's an interesting outing to the dinosaur park at Glen Rose. And when we went there in the 70s, I think it was free. I don't know if they started charging for it or not, but it's worth going to see. But the curious thing was that in this same riverbed, not only were there dinosaur tracks, but there were also human footprints. So here's a dinosaur footprint. Here's a human footprint out of the same kind of rock. It's Cretaceous limestone. And so they quarry out these chunks. And here's for all the world what looks like a big toe, four smaller toes, and a heel here that a human ran through this while it was soft. At the same time that there were dinosaurs running, maybe the dinosaurs were chasing the human. I don't know how that worked out. We can't tell. But the interesting thing about the human footprints, well, first of all, when this was reported, the scientists looked at that, and this dates back to the 30s, almost 100 years ago, 80 years ago. And when it was reported, they said, well, we believe the dinosaur footprint, but this human footprint must be something somebody carved out of the same rock. It's got to be fake, see? And that's the way they look at these things. When they find something that contradicts their theory, they assume somebody's made a hoax out of it. Well, they didn't find just one, okay? Here's a pair of them. And here's a normal human foot. Now, I think the size would put most of the NBA players to shame. It's not size 20 or 22, it's 36 or 40 or something. But what verse of Scripture relates to that? There were giants in the earth in those days, back in Genesis chapter 6. And that's evidence of that. Now, whoever carved this one out of the rock went back and had to do a second one to make a pair, you see here. And so scientists don't accept that. They're sure that all the other evidence is so certain in their minds that this has got to be a hoax. But the people, we talked to the my kids and I went, and I'm not sure if Gail went with us when we went down to talk to the owner of the land, and he took us down into the riverbed and showed us where these things came from. And it was his parents who had been working on it in the 30s, and they actually made a movie about it. I don't know. I guess it wasn't a bestseller, and probably it's been suppressed by the evolutionists. So anyway. Now I want to talk about another one here that's a problem. And I mentioned before, trilobites. Over here you have a standard trilobite, and the reason why it's called a three-lobed organism, trilo. It has generally a head plate, a rump, and then a tail plate. Now in this example, you can see the head plate, you can see the rump part. The tail plate is reduced, and so in some of them, the tail plate's bigger, some of them it's smaller. Some of them don't have quite as many segments in the rump. And so, but you can see this one is cracked here and here and squashed a little bit as it's flattened out between the rocks. There's tremendous pressures put on these things as the rock hardens. But that's a pretty good specimen. And it's something like 3 inches long. So it's not very big. And most rock shops and that have any fossils at all will have trilobites. There's a famous layer of trilobites called the Green River Formation in Utah. Has anybody ever been there? You can go to the rock shops in the area and do your trilobite hunting indoors. And I bought a couple from there as examples. I didn't bring them with me, though. I should have. And so they're easy to collect and they're not expensive because there are thousands of them. These things lived in the ocean. And here's an area where there's a dozen, but the thing goes on and on. It's thousands of them died together. I suspect they were pretty much the cockroach of the sea in the early days, abundant and readily multiplied, and probably were scavengers on the bottom of the ocean. And at the time of the flood, see, they can't swim. They crawl around on the bottom. And they can't fly, obviously, like cockroaches. But anyway, they're on the bottom, and so they occur in the bottom layers. As soon as the silt of the flood comes in, they get covered over first. And so they're mainly in the bottom layers of the ocean, but some of them occur in the early layerings of the flood, further on up. And some of them may have been in the bottom layers and got washed up. But once they are covered over with silt, then of course they suffocate and die, and they get embedded. And incidentally, that's an interesting thing about the fossils. Things don't fossilize today very much, because when something dies in the ocean and it settles to the bottom, there are all sorts of other animals around to eat it and to tear it up. So you don't have perfect fossils like these in a time when the scavengers are active. You would only have them in times when there's a catastrophe of some sort and all of the animals are in trouble, and there's too many dead animals to destroy them all. And so then you get fossilization abundantly, and that's the kind of thing you see in the layerings of the earth. So now here's a case that has been swept under the rug by the evolutionists. And this was in a museum in Utah for a while, and I don't know if it's still there or not. It's published in a book. The picture that I have was cut off at the end. This is a shoe print. Here's the heel. And it goes up, and it has a pointed toe on it, incidentally. And it was broken across there on both sides. This is the cast that fits in this indentation, where someone ran through the layer when it was soft, and it left footprints. This is a trilobite. It's not a very good trilobite because it's squashed, the way you would squash a cockroach, I guess. And so here's the other half of it. You can even see that the heel is worn down on one side, the way on the outside, the way your shoes wear. And this isn't much of a heel, but it's only about a quarter inch thick, but it's clearly a human foot that made this impression in a trilobite bed in the Green River in Utah. And not only have they found this one, but they found several children's bare feet prints there. I don't think they removed them like this, and I don't know if someone destroyed them because it's bad news to the evolutionists, but clearly humans existed all up and down this strata diagram that the evolutionists propose. I think this up here is another trilobite, which is in the toe of the cast in a slightly higher layer. Well, that's not all. There's one more I want to show you. This came from a quarry in England where they were quarrying a certain kind of rock. And you can see the layers of the rock here where the various layers of sedimentary rock are put down. And running right down vertically through this is the fossil of a palm tree. And so you have to imagine, and you see this arrow? That's 1 meter. That's over 3 feet. So the whole thing here is more than 10 feet from top to bottom. And so this palm tree according to the evolutionists, sat there for thousands of years while the soil piled in around it, and didn't get blown over or decayed or anything. It's embedded intact. Not only that, but the leaves are on the bottom. The leaves are down at the bottom of the thing, and the roots are on the top. It was obviously floating in the water at the time of the flood, and all of the layers were put in around it while it was within a very short period of time. So you see, it's not all one-sided. And I still don't understand how the evolutionists can say that we deserve to teach evolution in our school systems because it's a foregone conclusion. It isn't a foregone conclusion. It isn't a fact the way they would like to think that it is. Oh, it was vertical. Yeah, it's running up and down in the side of the quarry. When they took out some rock, there it sat on the edge of the rock that they were removing. And so it sat vertical. That's the layers went across it, you see. So, the Grand Canyon. Now, evolutionists would have you believe that the Grand Canyon was... They will admit that the Grand Canyon is recent. But recent in their mind means less than 50 million years old. And so here we have these horizontal layers which run all the way for miles without any deviation while there's mountain uplift going on all around. So there's some discrepancies in this whole story. And they would have you believe that the Colorado River down here, the bottom of this, and there's another creek that runs into it there, I think, that river carved out this huge canyon over millions and millions of years. And they calculate that by saying, we know how much water, the Colorado River water, how much silt it is carrying out day by day. And it's tons of soil that are brought out of there. But of course, to empty this whole canyon and expose all of these layers, even if it's only a dozen or so layers at the bottom of the column, would take a long, long time at the rate at which the silt is being removed now. But that doesn't take into account the possibility that the river began draining this basin when the soil was all soft. It was layered, but it was still not turned into rock. And so it would wash out quickly at the start. And then eventually, as it began to harden, as it began to wash all of this away, eventually gets down to where it's having to wear it away the way it is down here. Now this is down at the rock, at the bedrock, of course, and the rock is much harder. That's how it goes. That's how it looks when the rock is hardened. And I would propose that all of this was washed out while the rocks were still soft. Zion Canyon and the one at the top, which was, what's the name of it, at Bryce Canyon, there the rocks are soft and the weathering is going on pretty fast. And I think that's the better model for this. Okay, now let's see. So you have these two things to study, and then you have the critique, which includes many of the same things I've already told you and some others as well. Don't think this is all. It's just all we have time for. Our 45 minutes is pretty much over. Yes. Yeah. No, I don't think this is right. But this is what the geologists propose to teach our kids in school. And it's an assumption. There are many assumptions on their part. One of them, they tell you, we can tell how old these rocks are by radioactive assays of a series from uranium to lead, and we can tell you that this is a billion years old or this is 500 million years old. But they have assumptions about their clocks, and And when we talked about carbon 14 dating in here, I told you that there's a way by using the layers in the tree trunk, dendrochronology, that you can cross-check carbon 14 dating, and it's pretty good. But there's no way to cross-check uranium dating or any of the others that they've proposed, and they're still looking for better ways to tell how old a rock is without having to look and see what kind of fossils it contains. What your critique will tell you that I gave you is that they made this diagram, you see, assuming that evolution's true. The simplest organisms are on the bottom and the more recent organisms are on the top. And they identify the layers by the predominant kind of organism that it contains in fossil form. But there are all sorts of exceptions. There's another one that's mentioned in the critique. There's a human skull discovered embedded in a coal seam from the Mississippian layer. Well, that doesn't make sense. So they say, well, these are anomalies. Yeah, they are. And they're deadly. If you had that kind of anomaly with any other kind of theory, it would be tossed out or rewritten at the very least because it doesn't make sense. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. What I gave you there is what they're going to try to teach kids in high school and in college. But it's got problems. And I don't have any qualms about teaching it as long as they say this includes some assumptions and this is the way we think it is. But they want to teach it as an absolute fact, and it's not an absolute fact by any stretch of the imagination as far as real science goes. I can tell you that. All right. Any other questions about this? Our time is up. And next week now, come ready with your head loaded with thinking synapses, because we're going to talk about proving one way or the other as to what's true. And I'm going to talk to you about genetics next week. And maybe that's interesting to you anyway. You all have some of it in your body. Thank you. We'll see you next week. If anybody wants a book, I have a few of them here. The books contain most of the things that we've been talking about. Which handout? Okay. There's one of each. You're welcome. Yeah, sure. Let me turn off my mic.
Can I get one next week?
Sure, you can get. That's fine. $10.